Hi.
Welcome to Drinking the Kool-Aid.
Welcome.
I'm Megan.
I'm Hannah.
And today...
What mistake do you have to fix?
I don't think I have any. Get out of here.
I did tell Isaac, though, that we're gonna need a new little tune for that, and he's working on it.
Yeah. Adorable. Yeah. What can I say? I tried.
Okay, so this might be the first one, then.
In a while.
In a few episodes.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm sure there was something in there. I just didn't catch it myself.
All right. Well, then we'll call it a success.
Yeah. So when I catch them, then I call them out.
Perfect.
So, okay. So for this one, I read a really good article that was called Killer or Victim in D Magazine by Michael J. Mooney. And I also watched Dateline Behind Door 813.
What did you say the article was called?
It was called Killer or Victim.
Ooh, I'm definitely intrigued.
So that's for you to decide. It started on Super Bowl Sunday, 2014. It was the Seahawks versus the Broncos. Yes, okay. Recent. Many people were having parties this night, and Jonathan Cruz was invited to one of them, but he declined because he had actually just moved into his new apartment, and he had a lot to get done. His friend Emily texted him while she was at the party to let him know that the people throwing the party had a couch for sale, so she thought he might be interested in this.
And, yeah, from just moving.
Yeah, and so she sent him some pictures, but he didn't respond. A call went out to 911 at 1:30 p.m. on February 2nd, 2014, and it was Jonathan's girlfriend, Brenda Lazaro. She was crying and repeats, quote, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, please somebody help." The dispatcher attempted to calm her down and asked where she was. Brenda says, quote, "At the apartments." The dispatcher asked which apartments she was in, and she said, quote, "I don't know. I don't know. Please, please. He's dying. He's dying." She shouts the apartment number, 813. She repeated the number twice before saying she's near the corner of Beltline Road and MacArthur Boulevard in Couple, but she didn't know the name of the apartment complex.
That's freaking understandable.
Yeah, I mean, they just moved in, so maybe you could say, okay, I totally get that.
Dude, I have lived in the town we live in currently, you know, my whole life, and I'm gonna tell you what, the apartments that are not that far from here, there's like three different ones, and every time anybody mentions one of them to me, I'm like, that's which one again?
Yeah. And she wasn't even living there. Her boyfriend was.
Yeah, there ain't no way in hell I would have known.
Brenda spent most of her childhood in Mexico, and she did struggle with her English. She told the dispatcher that, quote, "He shoot himself. He's shooting himself on the heart, and he's dying right now."
Oh, no, that was so sad and so cute. It's just so cute when they, like, are missing words. I don't know why. I think it's adorable when, like, people have, like, that, like, broken English, and they're, like, skipping the "the"s and everything in there. I just think it's so cute. I don't know why.
3 minutes into the call, the dispatcher still couldn't figure out which apartment complex they were in, and Brenda was repeating her boyfriend's name. Jonathan? Jonathan! The dispatcher asked if he shot himself on purpose, and Brenda says no. Then she says, yeah, he did it on purpose. The dispatcher asked where he shot himself, and she said she didn't know. Quote, "There's too much blood. I'm just pressing on it." Jonathan had only lived in the apartment for 1 week. They were 4 minutes into this call, and Brenda still could not provide the name of the complex. So the dispatcher asked her if she could go look around, find some mail. Is there anything there that has the name on there? And she said there wasn't any mail, so he instructed her to go knock on the neighbor's door to verify the address. She said, quote, "No, I don't want to leave him alone." After 6 minutes, the dispatcher tells her again she needs to get the name of the complex, and she shouts, quote, "Oh my God, I think he's dead." The dispatcher responds, "I need you to go. Go now." 8 minutes into the call, Brenda found a neighbor and they told her the name of the complex, River Chase Apartments. The dispatcher told Brenda to stay outside, and she didn't listen. She walked back into the bedroom and said, "He's dead." The dispatcher stayed on the line and asked Brenda if she discovered her boyfriend like this, and what did she see when she first walked into the apartment? He's questioning what happened before the 911 call. Brenda says, quote, "We were just having a discussion and we were just talking. He just said that he loves me and I didn't believe him. He said he was going to prove that he loves me. I didn't know he had a gun." The paramedics arrived at 1:40 p.m. and they found 27-year-old Jonathan Cruz in his bed. The covers were up to his waist and there was a gunshot wound to the left side of his chest. He was dead, slumped to his left with both arms extended. The bullet from his own Sig Sauer 9mm went through his heart, lungs, and liver, then exited the right side of his back into the bed. The gun was sitting next to him on top of the blanket. Jonathan's parents, John and Pam Cruz, were at their home just a few short miles from their son's new apartment. Aww. And they were with their son, Christian, and their daughter, Danny. Danny's phone rang, and it was Brenda. And she said, "He's dead." Danny said, "Who is dead?" And Brenda said, "It's Jonathan." The family rushed to the apartment, and they were told that he had shot himself. They assumed Brenda had to be wrong, and they believed that an intruder must have been in the apartment and shot him. There was no way he would end his own life. His family told the police that Jonathan did not have a history of depression. He recently started a new job that he really liked, and he had moved into this new apartment, and he was excited about that. He had grown up using guns, and he was trained in firearm safety.
Okay, so he knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. His girlfriend, 26-year-old Brenda, said no, it was definitely suicide. She told the police that she spent the night watching TV in his apartment, and they were eating Chinese food and fighting about a woman named Emily. Brenda said she was at the foot of the bed sitting on the floor, and Jonathan told her to cover her ears, and that's when she heard the gunshot. Jonathan and Brenda had met at Wu Yi Shaolin. She was a teacher at a martial arts school in a Koppel strip mall, just a few blocks from the River Chase Apartments.
Oh, that's a cool occupation.
It is. Jonathan's sister Danny was best friends with Brenda. She took classes at Wu Yi, and Jonathan's mom, Pam, was also taking classes there. Jonathan asked his sister's permission to date her best friend, and she agreed as long as he promised not to ruin their friendship.
Okay, that is really sweet.
It is, to ask permission. I like that.
I love that.
Yeah. Jonathan was born in California, but he grew up in Irving. Pam stayed home to raise her three kids, and John was a lawyer and a pastor at the non-denominational Heartland Church. Their son, Jonathan, spent a lot of time with his grandfather in Montana, and that's where he learned how to shoot pistols. As he got older, he played the bass guitar and listened to Ozzy Osbourne and Green Day.
Nice!
Good choices. He was quiet and laid back. Jacob Ramsey met Jonathan in the ninth grade, and they were roommates for several years at Baylor. Jacob said, quote, "I was a little bit jealous of him growing up. He was this super athletic, good-looking guy, and he had this ability to just always be the nice guy. Especially through college, I could just never get mad at him." Jonathan may have always been nice, but he was also the messy roommate, and he was a really, really deep sleeper. He had to set three alarms to make sure that he didn't miss his classes. He set a traditional alarm clock, an alarm on his phone, and another alarm that vibrated his pillow, and he also had a fourth alarm, sort of.
Wow, I sure know people like this.
Jacob says, quote, "The fourth alarm was me hitting him in the head with the pillow."
Yeah.
During and after his college years, Jonathan had a handful of serious romances. His mom explained that he had, quote, a pick up the broken baby bird kind of thing. And, you know, with women.
Yep.
His friends said that he was a serial monogamist and he was sometimes trusting to a fault. His friend Jacob says, quote, he was the type of guy who liked to be somebody. He would always fall really hard and give the best of himself and a lot of money to a new relationship. He was always looking for a wife. When he dated a Muslim woman, he learned how to read and write some Urdu and bought a Quran. Like, he really put himself into these relationships.
Yeah, so he's, like, diving in.
Yeah. Once his relationships were over, they were over. He didn't get back together with the women, but he always stayed friends with his ex-girlfriends.
Yeah, no, I actually do that too, and everybody always thinks it's so weird, and I'm like, I don't know why it's weird at all, because the minute I'm done, those feelings are gone as fuck. They're out the window.
Yeah.
Not with him.
Maybe if I had ever dated people that didn't suck.
That's true.
Then I could understand that. Because, like, when I'm done, I'm done. Those feelings are goodbye. But also, get out of my life. I never want to know that you exist again.
Yeah. So for, like, the shitty ones, you know, they're definitely, I don't talk to them.
They're,
like,
dead.
There are quite a few people that I still talk to that I dated at one point. Mm-hmm. But, like, looking back on it now, it feels weird to even say that I, like, dated them at any point, because I'm, like, such good friends with, like, most of them now.
Yeah, that's true. In 2009, he graduated with a history degree and moved back to North Texas and worked at Dillard's, and that's where he met his very good friend, Emily. He said that she was basically the female version of him. He later got a job as an operations director at an urgent care clinic, and he organized a surprise baby shower for his coworker. With the money from his new job, he was able to rent the apartment in River Chase, and this was his first time living on his own.
Oh, no!
Yeah, so it was actually a really exciting time for him.
And he only got a week.
Yeah. His girlfriend, Brenda Lazaro's background isn't as easy to piece together. A man she dated for more than 4 years says that she told him she was born at Parkland in Dallas, but her sister, Azalea Lazaro Garcia, said that Brenda was born in Oregon. When she was 5, Brenda's family moved to Mexico, where her parents were from. Brenda told people that while she lived in Mexico, she witnessed a murder, but the details regarding who and where have varied. In one version of the story, she said that her uncle was murdered in front of her by the cartel, and her family had to flee Mexico, and that's why she had such a hard time trusting people. One of Brenda's best friends says that Brenda told her that she was actually kidnapped with another girl and then set free after the other girl was murdered.
Ruh-roh.
So that's why...
I mean, there's different stories for sure. I mean, I could definitely see some, like, somebody witnessing a murder in Mexico. Like,
absolutely.
That's 100% could see that happening. But
yes.
That is very weird.
Very different stories, and that's why I say it's a little hard to piece together what happened in her childhood here. When she was a teenager, her family moved to Irving, and her father got a job installing solar panels. Her ex-boyfriend says she told him that she was raped in high school, and she had a rough home life, and several friends remember her telling them that she was pregnant a few times, but she never gave birth.
Okay.
According to a profile that was on the Wu Yi website, she started Tai Chi and Kung Fu at North Lake College in the spring of 2006.
But?
No, she did.
Okay, I was like, is there going to be like another contradicting thing here?
No. The owner of Wu Yi, his name is Henry Su, and he said that she was hardworking and reliable. He said, quote, she doesn't say very much, but she's appropriately friendly.
Okay, that's kind of my favorite kind of person.
Sure.
Like, don't say very much, but you're friendly. Cool.
There you go.
Sweet.
After getting a Spanish degree from UTA, she worked as a substitute teacher and taught classes at Wu Yi Shaolin in the evenings. In May of 2013, she ended her 4-year relationship, and in November of that year, she started dating Jonathan. He told people that she just understood him, and they were similar in a lot of ways that he had a hard time describing. His sister Brenda says that he was always excited, or I'm sorry, I just said the wrong thing. JK, LOLOLOL.
Oh my God. Oh no.
His sister says that Brenda was always excited after seeing Jonathan, and she talked about having a future with him. She wanted to get married and have kids. Soon after they started seeing each other, they went on a double date with Jonathan's friends, Jacob and Emily. The couples met up at a Chinese restaurant, and Brenda barely spoke that night. It wasn't a huge deal at first because Jacob and Emily just believed maybe she was really shy or nervous, but they learned the real story later. Jonathan confessed to his friends that, quote, she was doing that because she didn't like the fact that Emily hugged him.
Oh, boy.
Uh-huh. So yes, that's a problem.
So that, like, couch text is going to come back around, isn't it?
It sure is.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a big part of things.
I figured as much. It sounded very ominous when you said it.
Did it?
Well, just because, like, when you...
It's kind of a random fact.
Yeah, when you point out a specific fact like that, it immediately puts it on my radar because I'm like, why did you put that in there? There's going to be a reason.
Right. And I mean...
And she's the one that sent that couch text, correct?
She Emily? Sure is. Yeah, Emily okay. is. Yeah. Yeah. And so basically, Brenda is upset that Jonathan hugged his friend.
Right.
Okay.
That's concerning.
And this wasn't the only time that Brenda's jealousy was showing during the 3 months that they dated. She brought up this hug between him and Emily every single time they fought.
This was only like...
Yeah, three months.
That, oh boy.
Yep, that and we're already at that level of jealousy.
That is worrisome.
Jonathan told his mom how jealous Brenda was, and he explained that she had a really rough childhood. And his mom said, you know what, maybe you should give her some time. Quote, eventually she'll see what a good guy you are, and she'll see she can trust you. Now, Pam did say that she absolutely did not know how extreme the jealousy was. Jonathan never gave her the full story.
Okay.
And if she had known how bad things really were, she would have told him to run, not to just wait this out.
Well, no, I totally get that because, you know, there is sometimes jealousy in the beginning
yeah.
when you don't know if you can trust the person or not. And so I see where she's coming from, where she's like, I'm gonna give her a little time. Maybe she just needs to adjust to it and learn to trust you, but...
Right, because you're 3 months in yeah. and you're having that. So I can see where she's coming from. Like, all right, let's just see what happens in a couple more months, you know? For Christmas that year, the Cruz family took a trip to Germany. Keep in mind, at this point, at Christmas, they had only been dating for 1 month, okay?
Okay.
Jonathan was enjoying a nice vacation with his family, and he sent Brenda some photos and videos, and she responded with questions about that hug from Emily and questioned him about the women who liked his Facebook posts.
Son of a bitch.
So, red flag, red flag, red flag. They argued over text messages for the next several nights, and around 3 a.m. on Christmas morning, they almost broke up. But the messages show that by 5 a.m., he had reassured Brenda that he truly loved her. In January of 2014, a few weeks prior to Jonathan's death, he and Brenda got in a long argument about one of his ex-girlfriends, and the fight lasted for days. And this was both online and in person. He always stayed friends with his exes, but he promised to break off contact with his ex to just end the fight. They didn't stop fighting, though. On February 1st, 1 day before he died, Jonathan confessed to his sister Danny that he felt like Brenda was trying to make him choose between having a relationship with her or keeping his friendship with Emily.
It's definitely sounding like that.
It does. And so he sent several texts to his sister and said that he basically had four choices at this point, and here's how he laid it out. One, fight it and try to make it better, which will probably never happen. Two, choose Brenda. Three, refuse to give up either and see if Brenda just ends it. Or four, end it with Brenda now.
I choose four.
Four would have been good, yes.
Yeah, it's a shitty situation because, like, he shouldn't have to be like, do I have to dump one of my friends to be able to stay with this person? Like, that's putting you in a very shitty position.
It's ridiculous.
But also, like, there are situations where sometimes somebody does need to be cut off from somebody that they've had contact with because, like, there is too much shit, like, and, like, you know, they sometimes will try to pursue, like, the other person will keep trying to pursue anyways, even though they know they're in the relationship.
For sure. So
it's just hard because, like, I'm in this situation in particular, absolutely not.
And I just want to clarify, too, because I know I've said a couple times that, like, he stays friends with his ex-girlfriends. Emily isn't technically an ex-girlfriend. They went on one date, right, and they both agreed it didn't work.
And that, and that's what I'm saying. She's not like some chick that's like,
no,
in his DMs every other night, like, hey, what you doing? Like, and trying to get a booty call or some shit.
She's with someone else.
So, oh my God.
She's with
no.
Jacob, his friend Jacob.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So there's really no excuse in my book here.
No, not in this particular situation, no. No, no, no.
So he told Danny that the first three options, quote, all had a strong likelihood of ending the relationship. After talking it through, he decided he wanted to break up with Brenda on his own terms, which, quote, limits contains the damage. On the morning of February 2nd, Jonathan sent his friend Jacob a text and asked if he wanted to go get something to eat.
Wait, I'm sorry. Just 1 second. So you said the day before he died is the day that he decided he was going to probably break up with her?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So on the morning of, he sends his friend a text and he's like, hey, do you want to go get something to eat? Jacob and Emily went to see Jonathan's new apartment. And they noticed that he did not have a lot of furniture, and it was surprisingly clean. He was the messy roommate, so that's just not what they were expecting here. Jacob had also grown up around guns, so Jonathan wanted to show him his two new guns. It was the new Sig Sauer, which was the gun later used to end Jonathan's life. And it was stored in its own space in his dresser. And the magazine was in and a round was chambered. So it was ready to go.
Okay. And then this is like now the day of.
The day of. So he's showing his friend.
So he's showing his, the gun that killed him, he's showing it
to
off.
A friend. Yep. Like, mm-hmm. He's proud of it.
Dude, look what I got.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's part of my new collection.
That's really weird.
Well, he was a competitive shooter.
Well, no, I'm saying it's really weird that he showed off his gun and then it's later going to be the exact one that kills him.
It is.
Because,
yeah.
Like, typically, well, I guess, like, if just like most stories I've heard, if somebody is going to do something to themselves, they're not typically showing off the gun the day before or the day of
right.
to their friends and being like, hey, look what I got. That's weird.
It is. It is very weird. And, you know, he actually took gun safety extremely seriously. The three friends did go to lunch at Anamia's Tex-Mex, one of Jonathan's favorite restaurants. And Jacob said, quote, looking back on it, he was a little awkward because he was afraid Brenda might find out that Emily was with us. As the food arrived, Brenda called. And Jacob said, quote, he was visibly nervous when he got the call. He knew Emily was there and he knew what Brenda was going to say. So he's like scared of his girlfriend right now. He talked quietly to Brenda. Then he handed the phone across the table to Emily and said, Brenda wants to talk to you.
Oh, dear God. Okay.
So Jacob said, quote, my wife has a bit of an attitude. She can be a bit of a boss lady. She doesn't let people run over her, but when she got off the phone, she ran to the bathroom crying. I was kind of shocked. Emily said that she tried to stay composed, but Brenda was screaming at her on the phone. She said, quote, "I tried to say we're just friends. When she met me, Jacob was there. She kept telling me I was a disrespectful little girl and I better stay away from her man and stop hugging him." The call really changed the vibe of things, so everyone packed up their food and left. Jonathan was really embarrassed about this, and he kept apologizing to his friend Emily.
Oh yeah, as someone who has been stuck in a situation like this before, it is so fucking embarrassing.
It is, it's mortifying.
Like, you just want to crawl into a hole right there.
Mm-hmm. Before they left, he said, quote, "That's it. I'm going home and packing her bag." He stopped taking calls from Brenda after she yelled at Emily, and she was, of course, getting very upset about this. The three of them went back to the apartment, and that's when Emily and Jacob invited Jonathan to the Super Bowl party. They said it would be good for him to just forget about his relationship problems for a while, but he had a lot to get done, so he declined. Around 2 p.m., he hugged Jacob and Emily, and they told Jonathan they loved him. At 10:52 p.m., Emily received a text from Jonathan's phone that read, quote, "I want to die." Emily said, that's not the way Jonathan texted. He always sent really long messages or a bunch of messages one after the other.
Okay.
It was never just one short one.
Yeah, and obviously, like, I don't know him, but even from what you've told me about him so far, that absolutely does not sound like something he would just, like,
just blurt
especially
out.
Especially with the situation. Like, I know he's trying to break up. Like, he just got himself in, like, his own apartment. And, like, it just, it's very abrupt. This feels very abrupt.
And he's already decided in his head, like, I'm done with this relationship.
Right.
I've had enough of it. So he's the one breaking it off with her.
Yeah. And it wasn't like a situation where he was like sitting there like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I can't get out of this. I'm stuck. Like, he literally was saying, I'm going to go home and break up with her.
Exactly. He made up his mind. Roughly 40 minutes after that text was sent, Brenda called 911 to report the shooting, which is where our story began. When Emily woke up the next morning, she still had not received a response from Jonathan after he sent that text. So she called he didn't answer. She had a bad feeling. So she got in her vehicle and started driving over to his apartment, but she got a call from her boyfriend and learned that Jonathan was dead. Also, I just realized too, I do want to clarify, during the Dateline show, Emily and Jacob were just boyfriend and girlfriend. And then they later got married.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's why some of the quotes of him is like talking about his wife.
Okay.
So yeah, that's what's going on there.
That makes sense.
They are married. As you can imagine, the night Jonathan died was chaotic and confusing for his family after they received the news. Some people from the church went over to their house to sit with them, and it was late into the night when they finally fell asleep. Pam hadn't been asleep for long when the phone rang, and it was Henry Su, the owner of the Kung Fu school where Brenda worked. He told Pam that he had just driven Brenda home from the police station, and they were talking about what happened. He asked Pam, "Do you want to hear it?" Brenda said she had gone to Jonathan's apartment that afternoon, and they fought, off and on, all evening. He told her to cover her ears, and he shot himself. Henry said that Brenda told him she was in the living room when Jonathan shot himself, but if you recall,
at the end of the bed.
Yes. She told the police she was at the foot of the bed when it happened. Now, Henry later denied saying that she was in the living room, but Pam said she knows what she heard, and this didn't make sense to her. The next morning, Brenda showed up to the Cruz family home, and she mourned with them. Pam says, quote, "I was probably taking care of her more than anyone." Brenda stayed at their home and slept in Danny's bed for the next three nights, and Danny held her while she cried. Then one night, Brenda slipped out of the home without saying goodbye. The family had...
And just, like, left?
Yeah, she just left.
Oh, okay.
Just disappeared into the night.
That's sketch.
And the family had planned the funeral and expected to see Brenda at the viewing, but she never showed up. She sent Danny a Facebook message. And just to clarify, Danny is his sister.
Okay.
Okay. Jonathan's sister. I don't want to get all these names confused. So she sends Danny a Facebook message about the funeral, and she asked if she could wear jeans. And she also wanted to know if the family would give her a ride there. But she never showed up to this either. They had saved a seat for her right up front with the family. And when she didn't show up, they got concerned because they thought, what if she harmed herself?
What if she did something to herself too? Yeah. Because you just never know how people react.
Exactly. So she later sent Danny a message and she said she was upset that more wasn't said at the funeral about her relationship with Jonathan.
What?
Yeah.
What?
So, Brenda sent a text.
The funeral that she wasn't even at?
Yes. Although, then it makes me wonder how she knew. Like, so, was she lurking?
Was she creeping somewhere, like, behind a tree, like, in a fucking movie or something?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Was she having someone message her? But that feels weird. Why would you...
Mm-hmm.
No, you would... That's weird.
It is. So, she sent a text saying, quote, "Why is it that your parents keep telling me they love me and understand what happened, but they kept me completely out of it? Then never mentioned how happy he was with me or anything related with me. They included his best friends, but not me."
Okay, but he has an entire freaking life that they're covering up there.
Not 3 months.
Not the 3 month relationship that he was in beforehand.
Yep, that's exactly right. We're celebrating a whole life here.
Wow.
Not just a piece. Jonathan's mom was pretty confused about this, and she said, quote, "They had been dating for 3 months."
What I'm saying!
That's not the kind of thing you talk about at a funeral. At this point, she was actually not suspicious of Brenda. She just thought that her behavior was very odd.
I'm suspicious. I'm just throwing it out there.
After the funeral, the Cruz family decided to change Jonathan's Facebook to a memorial page, but they realized they could not access it.
Because she had the info.
She sure did. So they had to go to Brenda and they asked for the password, and she said that she would give it to them, but they had to promise not to add any of his ex-girlfriends to the page. She said that they had a discussion and decided to remove his exes, so it's really his wishes. I just literally saw your eyes, like, flutter when I said that.
This is bad.
This is really obsessive. Yeah, like, and scary behavior.
So scary.
Jonathan's friends were still baffled by the text message that came from his phone saying he wanted to die.
Yeah, it's so weird.
And they just, the more they looked at it, they were like, I don't believe that he wrote it. Jacob was his roommate for a long time. And he said when Jonathan got really stressed out, he would actually just go to sleep. He didn't send cryptic text messages.
No, and you know. Like, I know damn well you would never, ever say anything like that.
No.
And you know I would never say anything like that.
Like, if we got that, we would know something's wrong.
Is very wrong.
Really and so, suspicious.
Like, yeah, I mean, you know your friends.
You do. About a week and a half after his death, his friends went to the Cruz family home and showed the message to his mom. And Pam immediately said, Jonathan did not write that. They told her about the weird lunch that they had with Jonathan on the day of his death and told her about that phone call between Brenda and Emily. And Pam said, quote, I didn't realize until then that she had a motive.
Oh, shit.
So, things are changing here. Jonathan's parents went to the couple police and told them they had witnesses who could verify that their son was planning on breaking up with Brenda on the night he died. The detectives told them that they believed Brenda was responsible for his death and they anticipated an arrest would happen soon, but they needed the family to be patient and to try to act natural when interacting with her at that kung fu school.
God, that's like...
That's asking a lot.
Gotta be impossible, man.
To control all of your emotions there and not do or say anything.
Act normal, when you know that there's a possibility that the killer of your child is standing right there.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I couldn't. The police did investigate the crime scene as a possible murder, even though Brenda said it was a suicide. They secured paper bags over Jonathan's hands and photographed the apartment. They ran tests for gunpowder residue and interviewed Brenda for hours that night, and they questioned her repeatedly after that.
Hell yes, so I'm actually doing it based off of a murder scene versus a suicide.
Yes, however, they screw up big.
Of course.
So I was in the same boat. I was so ready to sing their praises and be like, oh my gosh, yes. Which, don't get me wrong, I'm super happy they did this part. But later you're going to be like,
they dropped the ball. Got it.
Wow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The Dallas County Medical Examiner found that Jonathan did not have drugs or alcohol in his system and listed the cause of death as undetermined. The family waited for months, and every time Brenda didn't show up at Kung Fu, they thought this could be the day. Maybe they arrested her. Pam tried to ignore Brenda at Wu Yi, but after a few months went by, she changed her tactics. She tried to pay attention to her. She watched and listened to everything, just hoping that Brenda would slip up and she would crack the case. At one point, Pam sent an email to Brenda asking her what happened on the night her son died. Brenda explained that Jonathan had been really down for about 3 days before his death, and he was afraid of losing her. They were fighting, but she thought things were fixed, and so they started watching TV, then ordered some food. In one email, Brenda wrote, quote, "We talked about how many kids we wanted to have and when. We talked about our plans and how happy we were with each other." She said that later that night, he brought the argument back up and she went to the bathroom. When she came out, she sat down on the floor at the foot of the bed and was checking her phone. She said Jonathan said a lot of nice and sweet things to her, then told her to cover her ears. Pam asked Brenda what his last words were, and Brenda said he told her, quote, "Baby, I love you so much. You are my world, and I will prove it to you."
This is very convenient. How they were talking about, like, we were going to have kids, and I love you so much, and love, 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 love. And then all of a sudden, he takes himself out.
But also, how does that make sense? Like, hey, I want to marry you, and I want to have kids.
That's why I'm
but
saying.
But also, I'm going to prove my love by ending my life.
Right. And
what?
She, like, just like the way she's saying everything, it just sounds like she's trying to make it too conveniently. Like, oh, I love you.
He loves her so much.
Yeah.
Brenda said she ran to him and pressed on his chest as hard as she could to stop the bleeding. She said that during his last moments alive, quote, "I was just looking at Jonathan because he was trying to say something and reach my hand. I couldn't hold his hand because I was holding the phone with one hand and pressing on his chest with the other. But he was looking at me very scared. I told him I love him and I asked him not to leave me." Pam barely communicated with Brenda after receiving these responses, and a few months later, the case was reassigned to different detectives. They told Pam that the case was solvable. She said, quote, "They asked us to give them 6 weeks to review all the evidence. I was very hopeful again." Unfortunately, the new detectives reached the same conclusion as the previous ones. There just wasn't enough evidence to proceed. As the second anniversary of Jonathan's death grew closer, Pam and John started talking about filing a civil suit against Brenda for wrongful death. They hoped that this would give them a chance to look for more evidence. Pam said, quote, "It's not like we wanted anything from her. We just wanted the truth to come out. She had all these fantastical stories, and we wanted to get the story righted." They met with an attorney, but they were told that if they really wanted to get the case solved, they should hire a good private detective. That's what led them to Sheila Wysocki. When she was a student at SMU in the mid-80s, her roommate was raped and murdered. The case went unsolved until 20 years later, while Sheila was living in Nashville, Tennessee, as a stay-at-home mom. She had a vision of her roommate and decided to become an investigator. She started with background checks and cheating spouses and worked her way up to missing persons and murder cases.
Badass.
It's so cool. After she called the Dallas Police Department hundreds of times, her roommate's case was reopened and the evidence was retested. The DNA matched a rapist who had been out on parole at the time of the murder. So Sheila works with a network of experts on everything from speech patterns to handwriting analysis. When she heard about the Cruz story in 2015, she was intrigued by the case, and a few details stuck out to her. Men who end their own lives are far more likely to shoot themselves in the head, not the chest. Brenda claimed Jonathan took his own life to prove his love for her, but it doesn't make sense. Sheila says she is very selective about which families she will work with. Quote, "There's a sound in the desperation in a mom's voice. Pam had that. It says, you are my absolute last hope." She told the family that this case was called in as a suicide. If she discovered that it truly was a suicide during the investigation, that's it. It's over. She would stop everything and tell the family very bluntly what her findings were. She wanted to make sure that they could handle the truth if that's where the story led her. Sheila agreed to take the case, and she had the Cruz family ask the police for Jonathan's phone and computer. The phone screen was smashed, and its evidence envelope indicated that it had been found between Jonathan's mattress and box spring. The digital interactions in the weeks prior to his death did not indicate that he was depressed, but texts and Facebook messages showed just how often he and Brenda were fighting and how possessive she seemed to be. 3 weeks before the shooting, Brenda asked Jonathan on Facebook what he would do if they lived together and got in a fight. And he said, quote, "I would sleep just like I did tonight." So, I mean, his friend Jacob was right on with that.
Oh, man.
If he's stressed, he goes to sleep.
That's which, so good. It's like, it's not good, but it's good at the same time. Like, it's not a great thing to, like, ignore problems and just go to sleep, but it's really fucking funny that he just
I think it's kind of a superpower. Like, how nice if you're really stressed, you just go to sleep.
Like, all right, you know what? I'm done for the day. Good night.
I kind of wish I had that.
I'll wake up when I'm less stressed, thanks.
Exactly. Like, you feel better. Sheila started to put together a list of potential witnesses, and she interviewed Jonathan's neighbor, Stephanie Mitchell. She said that she heard a gunshot that night about 20 minutes before she heard somebody knocking on her door, and she looked through the peephole and saw Brenda. This neighbor has given two different accounts, though. In one statement, she believed she heard the gunshot 20 minutes before Brenda was at the door, but in another statement, she thought it was actually 45 minutes.
Okay, but either way, it's no 8 minutes.
Exactly. That's very far from 8 minutes. Sheila spoke to the manager of the Chinese food restaurant that Jonathan had ordered from on the night that he died. The manager said that the driver overheard a fight when they delivered the food and actually had to knock on the door several times before it was opened. The fight was so loud, he could hear it in the hallway. Brenda's ex-boyfriend, Matthew Kirk, this was the guy that she had dated for 4 years, and he said that Brenda was regularly cutting herself during their relationship. She had also pulled out her hair and slammed her own head against the wall. He wasn't allowed to even be in an elevator alone with another woman. He said she was, quote, "very jealous and insecure and got crazy whenever I got around another girl."
Okay, she's like really, really toxic.
Yeah, like, so really. This is not just something about Jonathan that she had a jealousy issue with. It's definitely with everybody. And she was with this guy for 4 years. So the jealousy even included his sister-in-law. He said that Brenda did not want him to go to the hospital on the day that his niece was born. He decided to go to the hospital anyways, and when he got home, Brenda was crying in the bathroom and her hand was full of blood. She had broken the mirror in the bathroom and used the shards to cut her wrist.
Because he met his niece?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Because he's around his sister-in-law.
Whoa.
This is real bad. Matthew said he and Brenda got into a pretty heated fight when he tried to break up with her, and she grabbed a pair of scissors and threatened to kill his mother. So she hopped in her car and sped off towards his mother's house, and he went chasing after her and called the police, and she ended up being taken to the hospital. After they dated for more than 4 years, she broke up with him through a text, and he said, quote, "That girl ruined me and the relationship between me and my family." On the morning after Jonathan was shot, Matthew said that Brenda showed up at his house and it was the first time he had seen her in months since their breakup. She was crying and repeatedly asked him, "Would you do anything for me?" He said, "Yes." And she asked him to shoot her. He said,
"Whoa."
Uh-huh. He said, "No." And she asked him if he would give her a gun so she could shoot herself. Matthew says Brenda told him that her boyfriend had been playing with a gun and accidentally shot himself in the head.
In the head?
She says in the head here, which we know it was not in the head. It was in the chest.
It just keeps getting weirder and weirder.
Because everyone's getting different stories here. So, private investigator Sheila met with Brenda's best friend, Karen Petrie, at the school where she taught. Karen ended the interview when she realized that Sheila was not a cop and she didn't actually have to talk to her. But she later testified that she had gone camping with Brenda a few weeks after the shooting and Brenda never mentioned Jonathan the entire time. She also...
That is very strange.
I mean, that's a traumatic event. And to not even say anything, that's...
Again, everybody copes in their own way, but...
Sure do, because I know I stop talking about things, so I can...
But like, yeah,
I... But that's a weird one.
That's a... Such a big thing. I feel like it would be very hard to keep that in. And, like, not have, like, a random breakdown at some point.
And even if you don't talk about it, I think you would at least be acting some sort of...
That's what I'm saying.
...odd way.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Like maybe not, like, mopey or something.
And especially if you, like, hold something like that in for, like, a long time. It, yeah. Like, all of a sudden one person will say something and it just all comes out.
Mm-hmm.
That is weird.
She also testified that Brenda told her she had an abortion the summer before the relationship with Jonathan began, and that the owner of the Kung Fu school, Henry Sue, offered to pay for it. Now, Henry denies this. Sheila wanted to know more about Henry and his Kung Fu school, so she decided to go undercover. She went to the school and told them that she was involved in a nonprofit that worked with victims of violent crimes, and she was looking for a martial arts school in Texas where she could send people for emotional and physical guidance. She went to the school several times to speak with instructors and students about Kung Fu. Then she signed herself up for the Tai Chi class. After class one night, she went to dinner with a small group of people, including Henry. Sheila was really surprised to hear that people kept referring to themselves as, quote, the family. It reminded her of a cult.
Of a cult? Yep.
Yeah. And she noticed that people would physically surround Brenda during breaks as if they were all protecting her. The Cruz family requested all the police documents, including the initial police report, the autopsy report, and the gunpowder residue tests. Using this, combined with photos from the crime scene, Sheila put together a video showing the trajectory of the bullet from the left side of Jonathan's chest to the right side of his back. She used computer animation that shows how difficult it would have been for Jonathan, who was right-handed, to pull the trigger, and another animation showing what it would look like if Brenda were the shooter. The heavy blowback, or kick, created by the Sig Sauer was strong enough, in theory, to at least knock the gun off the bed if Jonathan shot himself. According to the gunpowder residue report, Jonathan had residue on the tops of a few fingers on his right hand, but none on his right palm and none on his left hand. Brenda had residue on both sides of both hands and on her sweatshirt. No report mentions fingerprints on the gun or its magazine. Reports and photos from the night of the shooting show that when the police arrived, the magazine was found out of the gun in Jonathan's tie drawer. And this is not where his friend Jacob had seen it.
Yeah.
When he saw the gun a few hours earlier that day. Jacob says that Jonathan was really into fashion. Quote, his ties were all carefully rolled, each one, to make sure they didn't get wrinkled. He wouldn't have put something with oil and lubricant on top of hundreds of dollars worth of ties.
Oh, hell no.
I mean, you would protect that shit. Like, your collections, are you kidding me?
I ain't even gonna put something like that on a hoodie.
No.
I like my clothes.
Exactly. Jonathan loved his tie collection, and he was very meticulous about his clothing. It's not known if the magazine was removed before or after Jonathan was shot, but it's possible that whoever pulled the trigger didn't know there was a round in the chamber. An investigation narrative generated from the medical examiner's office the morning after the shooting, saying that Jonathan had a history of depression and that he, quote, was supposed to be taking antidepressant medication, but was non-compliant. It's unclear where this information originated, but it did not come from the Cruz family. Sheila and Pam requested Jonathan's medical records, and there was no mention of depression or prescriptions for antidepressants. There was a file showing that just days before he died, he had an injury to his right shoulder, meaning it would have been very difficult to fire the gun with his right hand, which was the only one with gunpowder residue on it.
And I feel like at that angle, too.
Definitely.
Yeah, especially if you have a shoulder injury, like, that angle, like, and because I think that that is why, like, a majority go for the head.
It's a lot easier.
Right, because you're not,
it's not like, so awkward.
Yeah. I mean, I know that's morbid, but
it's the truth, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. After reviewing everything, the private investigator, Sheila, developed a theory. She believed that Jonathan did tell Brenda he wanted to break up, and they got into a fight. They got into bed and went to sleep, just like he said he would do if they fought. Jonathan went to sleep, then Brenda sent that text message from his phone to Emily, then smashed it. She thinks that Brenda grabbed Jonathan's gun, aimed it at his heart, and pulled the trigger. The sound of the cocked gun may have woken up Jonathan, and he might have tried to grab the gun with his right hand, explaining the gunpowder residue on that hand. Brenda ejected the magazine and hid it in the tie drawer, then waited a few minutes before calling 911. Then she was intentionally slow to ask neighbors for the address because she wanted to make sure he was dead before they got there. And this is, of course, just a theory. This is all alleged. One of the major problems with that theory is that she believes Brenda wanted to wait until Jonathan died before calling for help, but it's been argued that he was potentially alive during the call. It's believed that a man can be heard moaning in the background, and the sound occurs 50 seconds into the call and again at the 2:50 mark. There was also a dog in the apartment, though, so it's possible the dog was making a noise in the living room that could be heard. They did play a clip of the audio in the Dateline episode, and I have no idea what I was hearing. Like, I tried to play it over and over, and to me, it didn't necessarily sound like a man moaning, but I can't definitively say that's not what it is. Sheila put together a file and went to the police department, but she says they were not interested in anything that she had to show them. A spokesperson for the police says the case is open, but not active. Pam Cruz says the entire experience with the couple police has left her feeling confused. Quote, I want to think well of the police, so I don't know what to think. I'm normally a person who is very much pro-police. I think they get a bad shake, and I don't want to add to that. I'd like to think it's a bunch of good people held back by budgetary restraints. I'd be real sad to think that I'm wrong. Brenda Lazaro got married and had a baby. She and her husband, Jason Kelly, both attend Wu Yi. Jonathan's mom and sister still participate in Kung Fu demonstrations, but they go to a different school now. Brenda's friends from the school, including Henry Su, do not believe that she's capable of murder. Her ex-boyfriend also says he doesn't think she could have done it. He says, quote, "I think she's more of a talker than a doer," which I'm going to say that's a little interesting because it was more of a talk or more than a talk when she jumped in a vehicle and tried to flee to his mother's house with a pair of scissors. But right, what do I know?
To murder her.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Brenda's attorney says she categorically denies any accusation of wrongdoing and has not wavered in her story. A retired Houston police homicide detective testified that he is confident Jonathan Cruz did not shoot himself based on several factors, including his right-handedness, a recent shoulder injury, the orientation of the muzzle stamp on his body, and the direction the bullet traveled. Daryl Robertson said, quote, "It defies common sense that he would do that as his last act." He explained that Jonathan would have endured shoulder pain in order to aim the gun at the spot where he was shot because of that recent shoulder injury.
As someone who's broken their shoulder, it hurts like hell trying to move your arm. I'm not even kidding. Every last movement. I know you didn't say like he broke it, like he just injured it, but as someone who's like been there, holy shit, does that hurt.
Well, and I know it's been argued that maybe he wouldn't care if he's going to end his life because the bullet's going to cause a lot of pain too. So like, why would he give a shit about his shoulder? And I can understand that, but it still doesn't make sense to me.
I can too, but also it doesn't to me either because like, if that is going to be your last moments, why would you be putting yourself in mass amounts of pain?
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you just go for the head? Like, if right. you're a gun enthusiast, you know that that's going to be the easiest way.
And like, yeah, I mean, again, you would go for the easiest way, I would think, if you had issues in your shoulder like that. Because, yeah, it seriously, it hurts so much to move it. Like, it swells really bad, too. Like, your whole shoulder swells when you injure it, and it actually makes movement hard.
Yeah. The Cruz family filed a civil lawsuit against Brenda, alleging that she shot him to death in a jealous rage. On the 911 call, they showed how Brenda couldn't seem to remember the address, yet she helped Jonathan pick out the location of the apartment, and she worked across the street. You could argue that she's familiar with the area, but maybe she could have just been flustered and forgot. Or was she stalling on purpose? The gunpowder residue on Jonathan's right is on Jonathan's right hand. So if he shot himself, it would have been with the right hand, and the gun was shot at close range. If you look at the trajectory of the bullet and you believe Jonathan shot himself, he would have had to hold the gun in the most awkward way. And I'm going to try to explain this. I had to Google some of the terminology, so bear with me on this. The gun is in his right hand, and the muzzle would be pointed to the left side of his chest. That means he is reaching his right arm across his chest. The gun is tilted on its side, so the grip is aimed to the left. When they showed this in the Dateline episode, they showed that his thumb would be on the trigger. A Sig Sauer has a hard pull on the trigger. With his shoulder injury, he would have been in a ton of pain if he twisted that way. And I see you over there trying to, like, do that.
Yeah, no, I was just like, as you were telling it to me, I was, like, picturing it in my head and, like, trying to move my hands in the motions you were saying because I'm just, like, already, like, moving my arm up across my body. I can already, like, feel all the shoulder movements and everything and like feel it getting more awkward as I'm like putting my elbow out. Like, you know what I mean? Like it just gets like more awkward the more I like put my hand towards me.
Right. And I mean, again, like with his knowledge of guns, he would know how to properly hold the gun. And if he really wanted to get the job done, like if this was his true intention, you're probably going to go for the head or the mouth. Like that's usually where men put the gun. There is a theory that Jonathan didn't know there was a bullet in the chamber and that this was all a tragic mistake.
No, because you said he was all about gun safety earlier and nobody that fucking is about gun safety is going to fuck around even if they think like there's nothing in the chamber. They ain't going to fuck around with it.
Exactly. And even if that was the case, then why would Brenda's story change so many times with everybody else? Like, then she would have nothing to hide. Right. That doesn't make sense to me. She told her ex-boyfriend that Jonathan shot himself in the head, but he was shot in the left side of his chest. She told some of her friends that she was at the foot of the bed when he shot himself. But then she told others she was in the bathroom or the living room. You know? And if she was at the foot of the bed or in the bathroom, how did she get gunpowder residue on both hands and on her shirt?
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I do realize that if you're in close proximity, you are going to get some gunpowder residue on you.
Yeah, but she would have been facing away from it.
She's facing away and it's on the top and bottom of both her hands, but only on one of his hands.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense. To be clear, Jonathan's death has not been ruled a homicide and Brenda has not been charged. She pleaded the fifth about 130 to 140 times during the civil trial, so she didn't answer anything. The jurors attempted to recreate the trajectory of the bullet and they did not believe there was any possible way Jonathan could have shot himself, even as an accident. In a civil case, you only need the jurors to believe that it's likely that Brenda's responsible. It doesn't work the same as a criminal case, but the jurors said that they believe the evidence was strong enough that Brenda was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. The jurors felt that this should have moved forward as a criminal case. After a three-day civil trial in 2022, the jurors deliberated for less than 3 hours and Brenda was found responsible for Jonathan's death, and the Cruz family was awarded $206 million in damages because of the jury's final conclusion. The verdict is mainly symbolic. It's not likely that the family will get much money at all from Brenda. The verdict provides some validation for the family and backs up their suspicion that she could be responsible for his death. The Cruz family's private investigator, Sheila Wysocki, said, quote, "This was never about money. This has always been about telling the story of what happened to Jonathan." 5 months after the verdict, the family was told there was insufficient evidence to proceed with criminal charges. This is based on where the bullet ended up. When the police were processing the scene and looking for the bullet.
Oh my God.
It's so bad.
I'm going to be so mad. I already know it.
They disassembled Jonathan's bed, so the bullet could have rolled around. They don't actually know where the bullet was in the bed. And there wasn't photos of this. The first officer on the scene picked up the gun and moved it away from Jonathan's body, so there isn't photos to prove where that was either. He moved it from the bedroom to the kitchen. Also, the police waited 6 months to test the gun, and by that time, it had been sent to the lab and swabbed for DNA, which wiped away the prints.
Yo.
I told you it was bad. They found unknown DNA on the gun in addition to Jonathan's DNA. The police never got Brenda's DNA. A DNA sample that was labeled with her name was sent to the lab, but it was actually a sample of Jonathan's blood from her hands. Jonathan's parents, Pam and John, say they will never give up fighting for answers about their son's death, and they also want people to remember how he lived, their big-hearted, goofy son. The doting big brother and best friend who brought laughter into all their lives and loved every minute of it. He was excited about life and enjoyed every day.
I know we're not supposed to lean one way, but I'm going to have to lean towards the juror's decision here.
It looks real bad.
I'm so disappointed
that the police didn't process this scene properly. Because it sounds like if it had been, there may have been a different outcome.
Yeah, I'm sure there could have been, but
I do hope that they find something.
It's so frustrating.
To prove who truly did it.
Right. No, I obviously definitely want that. There are a lot of sus things happening, though.
There's some really, really weird shit.
Like, really weird.
So.
And a lot of things that don't add up here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I would say there is no way you're going to convince me this was a suicide.
Well, and I'm going to say, like, you said this was, like, in 2014? Okay, so this was, like, 2014. Yeah. At that point, we can do better with processing scenes.
We absolutely can.
This wasn't like the 90s where, like, or, you know, even further back where you're like, oh, things got messed up. You know, it was kind of common. No, like, this was 2014. We should be able to process a scene a little better
by and now. And, like, here's the thing, okay? Jonathan was already dead when the police arrived on the scene. So it's not something where they had to quickly move and get him, you know, to an ambulance right. And, you know, evidence got moved.
And removing the weapon because he's, yes. Like, possible because he's alive. No, he wasn't alive.
That would make complete sense to me and I would overlook it. But in this case, you get there, he's already dead. Why are we not snapping pictures first before touching anything?
Right.
To prove where it was. But no, that gun now traveled from the bed to the kitchen counter.
Which is so bad. Yeah. I mean, it would have been really nice to know the position and where it was sitting when they walked in.
Yes.
It would have been real helpful.
And trust me, I get that everybody makes mistakes, but unfortunately, these kinds of mistakes, when you're processing scenes, yep. Mean that people that are guilty walk free.
Well, and when it comes to that kind of job, like, you can't make mistakes. Right. Like, everybody does, but you literally can't. Like, when it comes to that type of thing, it's got to be something that you have, like, quadruple thought over before you even consider doing anything, because you can't afford to make mistakes.
And there's not one officer there. Is nobody else saying, like, whoa, don't do that.
Right.
Hold up. Let me snap a couple photos first.
For sure. You know,
like, let's help each other and watch each other's backs. Come on.
Man.
Because this is very frustrating.
Well, though, that is, since it is, like, semi-recent-ish, maybe we'll get an update in the next couple of years.
Oh, here. I hope so. I would love to see an update on this
case. I would,
case.
Too, actually.
Just to get, you know, some things cleared up and that poor family, everything they've been through with that.
No, yeah, absolutely.
All right, so make sure to follow us on any of your podcast apps. Tell us the stories you want to hear. Like us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Leave us a 5-star review if you love us. Tell your friends. Tell your cats. Bye.